The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events.
If you're stuck with an equity portfolio and are going to be long out the ears in a traditional allocation, you should be thinking about at least three things: liquidation and raising cash, getting some sort of a hedge, a la the tactical short, owning gold as an offset to market chaos. You've been told over and over and over again. And if you haven't taken action at this point, again, every opportunity has been given.
Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. Dave, you had a business trip last week to California since the last time we've talked, and you had a chance to have a little lunch at a yacht club. Just tell us about your travels.
Yeah, Marina Del Rey Yacht Club with one of our longstanding clients. So we go back almost 40 years.
Yeah.
And then after that, went on a run from Venice Beach up to Santa Monica because Marina Del Rey is right there.
Because you could.
Yeah.
Right. And you're training for this next half Ironman.
That's right. That's right. And then a friend of mine went to dinner, and the story was that we were going to have the best steak in Southern California. So we went to a place called The Butcher's Daughter.
And you were looking forward to protein.
And that friend had forgotten that this was an all-vegetarian restaurant. Oh. So The Butcher's Daughter is the girl who's seen it all and won't touch a thing.
She gets her protein from what? Beans, I'm guessing.
It's red chickpeas and what have you.
Dave, before we get too far in the commentary, I want to mention that Forbes interviewed you, and our listeners can tune in and listen to that interview. What was it? It was about an hour.
Yeah, so there's an audio that you might want to listen to, and then just a very short write-up by Jerry Boyer. And you can follow the link at McIlvaneyICA.com. My last name, McIlvaney, McIlvaneyICA.com. And that'll get you over to the Forbes site, a generous little write-up from Jerry, and then about an hour audio where we talk about legacy, the specific aspects of the book. We talk about how both in the context of family and at the level of sort of national debt and fiscal policy, we are under-reserved, and how the issue is never really crisis.
Right.
It's if you have enough resources to deal with crisis. And that's where our conversation swirled a little bit. So if you want to have some more, you know, food for thought, join us for that hour interview on Forbes.com.
Well, and while we're putting invitations out to listen to something else, make sure that you also register for the Tactical Short quarterly call. If you're listening on Wednesday morning or Thursday morning, there's still time to register for the Doug Noland Short quarterly call over at mwealthm.com. I mean, that's one, whether you plan on ever investing in the short fund or not, just to listen to Doug Noland and have some interaction, that's worth it all.
Yeah, I mean, our team continues to be built out with really top quality people. And so to get some of our perspectives on the market dynamics and the impact from trade tariffs and the consequences that come from higher rates, that'll be Thursday at 4:30 Eastern Standard Time. And you will want to register ahead of time. We've got about 4 pages of questions already submitted. And feel free, if you want us to address your questions, to send them also as you register so that we have some time to digest that and prepare to give you the best possible answer.
Well, it seems perfect timing to have this call because, of course, we've talked year after year after year that there is a time in the year, every year, that the stock market does well and the time that it does poorly. You know, when you average everything out, and we're, you know, November to April typically is when the stock market does its work. And then from April, you know, back on over to October, that's when it takes a lot of it away. So it's good to listen to Doug and hear what to expect, especially if you own some stocks.
Yeah, you know, the November to April timeframe, even through the end of March, that does well. Those 6 months tend to do well in large part because you've got year-end contributions to retirement funds and then the April 15th deadline, which motivates people to get dollars in for their 401ks and IRAs and things like that. And that funds sort of a dumping of money into the markets. The other side of the coin is that there's not as much flow from April to October, typically less dollars flowing into the markets and a greater propensity for downside moves in the worst half of the year or the not so good months, which, you know, again, from here to October, that's what it is considered to be.
Well, and sometimes we have a bias because, you know, Goldman Sachs has a computer model that if it says that it's bullish, Of course, it comes right out on the news. Bloomberg reports it. Everyone's happy. This, a couple of weeks ago, the model said that they had turned bearish. Well, the bias kicked in. And they immediately covered up.
Right. You've got the quantitative model, which is warning of a bear market. There's the Goldman Sachs bull bear indicator registering north of 70%. But the firm's analysts and strategists are telling investors not to worry. We're getting a misread due to a lack of inflation or whatever the case may have been. But if the computer model tells you what you want to hear, you pay attention to it. If it tells you what you don't want to hear, then you figure out how to justify ignoring it.
We all have that bias with things that we love, right?
I mean, it's just care. Well, and for Goldman Sachs, it's a love of money above all things.
There you go. There you go.
You know, the Dow at 24,682, if you recall, this is where it began to break down. It gapped lower. And for anyone who's interested in technical analysis, filling gaps is an important thing, particularly if we are, in fact, heading lower. So the price action broke down at 24,682. You've got a huge gap. And this week here, even within the next day or so, we're likely to fill that gap, which again, in my opinion, technically opens up for a much longer term move lower thereafter.
Well, and let's linger there just for a moment, because for the person who doesn't actually look at charts, what you're talking about is when you have a close, let's say, in a market on a Friday, and then that next Monday, it opens up dramatically lower or dramatically higher. It creates, or it can create, a gap in the chart that usually technicians at that point will say, all right, no matter what the direction of the market is, that gap will come back in and get filled at some point. Charts usually have somewhat of a continuity, even if the gap gets filled weeks later.
That's right. So radical volatility, which pushes prices from, you know, $3 to $7, that $4 difference between it on the way up, arguably the price will come back down to the $4 gap.
Right.
Between 3 and 7, and it'll fill before it goes much higher. And the same sort of gap theory applies on the downside too. So we've had a gap sitting there at 24,682, and it's in the process of filling.
The market's been coming up, mm-hmm. trying to fill the gap. Once that gap gets filled, your thinking is that the Goldman Sachs model might be accurate and that we might be in a bear market.
Well, and this is something Doug and I have talked about. There's this incessant volatility, which for many investors begins to fray the nerves. Mm. And, you know, you're up 500 points, you're down 500 points, you're up 1,000, down 1,000. We mentioned this last week in relation to Mr. Bogle from the Vanguard Group, who would say, I've seen the market down 25%. I've seen the market down 50%, but I have never seen this kind of intraday or intra-week volatility, not in my entire career. So what does that volatility do to people? I think it wears them out.
Yeah. And, you know, to contrast that with what we had for years, which was no volatility, to me, I actually prefer it right now. It's nice to have some movement in the market, but aren't we getting mixed messages right now from the economy? I mean, we have some things that are down and then some things that are clearly showing that we might be in a growth phase.
Sure. So if you look at housing and retail sales, you know, third month of declining retail sales from the Commerce Department, and at the same time, almost 9.4% increase in credit card usage with delinquencies and defaults in the credit card category rising. This week, with earnings out from JP Morgan, we also had a pretty big write-off of credit card loans. The consumer's maxed out. Now, extracting home equity is not a part of the answer to this cycle. You might have seen that circa 2006 and 7, but credit cards are standing in as sort of the last resort, and to some degree, we're there. And then you've got numerous other economic indicators that are not confirming that weakness in retail sales. And again, back to the volatility issue, I think this is where it stems from. On the one hand, a positive number comes out. On the other, a negative number. So on the negative side, you've got retail sales, and then you've got new home sales as well, which, you know, again, 3 months in a row, we've seen declining sales volumes, even though you've had a rise in price.
Right.
And so, I mean, what it tells you is something's not real healthy. When you look at any market, a part of the variable is price. The other part is, you know, the quantity or throughput in that market. So, you know, talking to realtors in different places around the country, it's been fascinating to hear them say, oh, no, we're not seeing that many transactions happen, although prices are still on the rise.
Well, and that's the point. We've talked so many times about prices not necessarily meaning economic strengthening. Just because prices rise doesn't necessarily mean that we have economic growth.
Well, and if you recall, I mean, the majority of the last 9 years, we had no economic improvement, but we had a massive financial market improvement on the basis of central bank intervention. So prices were being driven higher on a sea of increased credit and expansion of liquidity. Now we have some economic improvement, kind of the other side of the equation, some economic improvement, and central bankers are having to decide whether or not the liquidity provisions are going to stay, whether or not they're going to keep liquidity in the system. And it's kind of a catch-22. If they pull the liquidity, prices drop. If they don't pull the liquidity, it signals a disingenuous stance on the economy. So the last plausible reason to keep liquidity in the system has
been...
was
the inflation target.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, and we're there. So why, if you're Powell, I mean, at this point, I'm not going to say there's a gun to his head, but they've been using this lack of inflation as a reason to continue to stimulate the monetary process.
Yeah, I think that the discussion with Doug for the tactical short is going to be interesting for a number of reasons. But again, you're kind of at the confluence of price action and liquidity ebbing and monetary policy and, you know, throw into the mix a whole host of geopolitical concerns. It's a real interesting backdrop as an investor to not have some sort of a hedge.
Well, and the central banks don't seem to even be necessarily on the same page, because the European Central Bank still is very dovish.
Right. On the other hand, you've got the Fed minutes, the most recent, which were somewhat hawkish. Powell is less likely to be a Wall Street doormat than his predecessors, you know, which suggests that the coming months is going to be a challenging environment for traditional equity investors and equity allocations. I mean, in point of fact, it's not the economy. It's not the economy which leads the securities market. But it's the other way around. It should not come as a surprise to see the stock and bond market top and the economy still improving on sort of a sequential basis. I mean, if you can put this in your mind, sort of envisage a long line of rail cars, the engine of liquidity turns a corner long before the caboose of the economy does. And liquidity is the key, particularly in a world of fiat currencies. Economic leadership, that being in the equation, that was the driver, right, of markets. But that was jettisoned once it became vogue to abuse Keynesian and monetarist theories.
Well, let's go back and look at a little bit of history, though. We've been taught, Dave, and I remember being taught this in economics class, that we really didn't need to have the Great Depression of the 1930s. Gosh, if we would have just had Keynes or Friedman or the monetarist policies, they could have just printed money and kept us from a depression. Now, I think that's a lie, personally. I think ultimately what happens is you have inflation or what have you. But that's the history behind this thinking.
Right. And there's a mantra which is repeated by modern economists, and it's supposed to contain some sort of cosmic truth. And that is that the great crash was not an inevitability.
Right.
The deflation of the 1930s could have been avoided, but greater liquidity was needed via Federal Reserve money printing. And if we had utilized that tool, we would not have had the Great Depression. So now the central bank community errs on the side of too much rather than too little. They run scared, but a part of it is based on, again, on this mantra assumed to contain some cosmic truth, but it may in fact be specious history.
You know, if we were to look at how things can change very, very quickly, and I love your train example, okay, because you're right, the engine turns the corner long before the caboose. Federal Reserve policy has always been, at least on paper, to remove the punch bowl before that caboose shows up around the corner. Otherwise, you have, you know, inflation. But let's just look at the last 3 weeks. The tech darlings, okay, Facebook, Google, these guys have just, they could do no wrong up until this point. And what's happened, something that is relatively unpredictable and not necessarily likened to the market at all, there's public perception. Facebook and public perception is changing. Tesla and public perception may be changing. Those types of things you can't predict ahead of time just looking at charts.
Well, and one more thing, just in reference to a conversation that Dave Burgess, one of the guys on the wealth management team, a conversation that we had last week, the perception that interest rates have been coming up in the last year. Again, the Fed follows the market. it does not lead the market because interest rates have been moving up for nearly 3 years.
So it's reacting. It's not proactive.
They are late. They are behind the curve. Mm. They are not setting the trend in rising interest rates. They are catching up to what the market is determining a proper rate of interest should be. Right. So there's a multi-year gap here where the Fed sat on their hands and did nothing. And there was growing concerns that, hey, maybe they're late. Well, no kidding. Now, in that case, just look at a chart. The evidence is there. But, yeah, I mean, what you're suggesting with these tech darlings, the reality is that the general public can decide that they don't love them anymore very quickly. Very, very quickly. Firms like Google, Facebook, sort of caught aiding and abetting the deep state and in spying on Americans and others around the globe. And all of a sudden, your users have sort of a shift in perception from, I thought you were helping me connect with family. Now I discover that you are harming me with the data I provided. And again, we're talking about a psychological shift in perception from, I like using this venue, to, this venue is taking advantage of me.
Yeah. Well, and why does it say NSA right before Facebook? That's what I'm wondering. Why does my screen now say, this is a product of the NSA? Or am I the product NSA?
The domestic spying abuses actually go way back, starting under George W. And if you're looking at NSA abuses, and a lot of this stuff has come out as a result of, you know, Julian Assange and Mr. Snowden. We know more about the domestic spying program under George W. Mm. It continued through the Obama administration. In recent months, it's become clear that the FBI plays by its own rules, just as the NSA has for a long time. And, you know, now you've got these two data collectors, aggregators, and stores, the tech giants. Are you telling me that what they have in storage is not readily accessible to the intelligence community?
Well, ask Paul Verini. Okay, the last couple of weeks of our show. You know, of course it is.
You must assume that it is. So, I mean, the Facebook congressional hearings introduced many here in the U.S., in the general public, to what the actual business model is. And I think it was a little bit surprising. Rather than it being sort of, let's connect the world and be a relational nexus, the business model is what? You're selling what? Data on customers? What? To advertisers? And again, you're the product. You've been monetized. Your personal information is the best way of getting in front of an advertiser and saying, we've got this many people who are frequenting these pages and your ads are going to be seen. It's the same thing that you used to have or still have in print media and on television. You have to prove your viewership. And if you can prove your viewership, then you can charge higher rates for your advertisers.
This is not just human analysis. I mean, if you look at some of these predictive algorithms, some of these genetic algorithms that are artificially intelligence oriented, where you've got computers that are actually taking this data and thinking things before you've thought them, or at least they're trying to.
Right, because what you've provided is narrative. What you've provided is habits, pictures,
data,
and buying patterns, all of which, exactly,
yeah,
data which reveals how you think. And if you had a predictive algorithm, which, as you say, there are many of them out there, would and can reveal the high probability of what you're likely to do next, right? So what we have is a voluntary submission to a Big Brother data gathering. And this goes back to what Julian Assange said back in 2011. For those of you who don't remember, he's founder of WikiLeaks, and he said that Facebook was a spy machine for U.S. intelligence. I quote his exact words, the most appalling spy machine ever invented. Users are creating the most comprehensive database for U.S. intelligence. Just an interesting insight.
Well, war is fought on many levels. We've talked about how war over the last couple of decades has been fought in the currency realm, okay, with currencies, the U.S. dollar, of course, being the largest military force in the world, not with carriers and bombers, but just with the Treasury Department and the Federal Reserve and the reserve currency status. But what we're seeing right now is actual military action. You know, what went on in Syria, I've got some questions about what went on in Syria, Dave. Let's look at some of the angles. Why did it happen?
Yeah, I think there's more questions than answers. Yeah. I mean, one thing that history teaches us is the facts provided for public consumption are always narrow in scope. And by design, they are to bring the public into a desired disposition or conclusion. So, I mean, you can go years or decades after historical events and you then have a more exhaustive set of facts that becomes available And when you have those, then it reframes the decisions made in the past.
So you're thinking the Lusitania or Pearl Harbor. You've got the smoking gun where you look back and you go, no, wait a second.
You're told what you need to be told so that there's political support for the actions that were taken.
So tell me about the grassy knoll, that type of thing, right?
Right. Yeah. But politicians never make choices without sort of that sensitivity to public perception.
Yeah.
And yes, sort of guiding the course for perception management. In this case, you've got the UK, you've got France, you've got the US, all of them involved. And for any of them, it brings them together. They're sharing intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
A number of them, both France, I think Macron was the most vocal in terms of his red line commitments, and Trump as well. And so you cross this line and this is what we're going to do. But the fact that they did it all together and no one acted unilaterally opens up for the possibility of political deflection later on.
Well, if you recall last year, okay, Trump was having dinner with the Chinese president at the same time that the Tomahawks were flying into Syria. Now, I have a couple of questions, okay? One of them, we'll just leave it off to the side, but it is interesting those who did not participate. Germany stepped aside. They had no interest in this. But why didn't we use Tomahawks? Why were we using B-1 bombers? Are we sending a message that's larger than Syria itself?
Yeah, well, when it comes to Germany, I mean, keep in mind that if your audience isn't really Assad in Syria, in fact, it's the Russians or the Chinese, you know, you've got your tradable goods sector in Germany, which is very sensitive to the product that can flow to China, and you've got an energy dependence on Russia. Right.
Yeah.
So you want to be careful.
So forget Syria. You just don't want to make Russia or China mad.
Well, that's right. And,
yeah.
And so the real appraisal is, did this have as much to do with Assad as it did with a larger chess game afoot? You know, the use of the B-1 bombers, if you look at the firepower used by the B-1 bombers in Syria, they had the capability of 40 times that.
So we used a small version of it. It was more to send a signal.
Yeah,
okay.
Exactly. I mean, think of playing marbles. We just flipped a little marble, and then imagine that giant stone that chases down Indiana Jones as he's trying to escape.
You know, I mean, that's the difference.
Right. It's we could have done more here, just so you know.
But were we talking to Syria or were we talking to Russia?
I think the B-1 bombers, you make that pretty clear, that a broader audience was key. Delivery of said explosives using B-1s versus cruise or Tomahawk missiles, that sends a strong message to Russia and to China and to North Korea. So yes, we blew something to smithereens, but it still communicated restraint. There's a lot more of where that came from. So again, the message was not to Assad. I mean, even Trump's Friday comments included Russia and Iran and, you know, don't forget China and North Korea.
Mm-hmm.
What do you have after Friday, Saturday, and the weekend? The ruble has plunged. Russian equities are in retreat. The Iranian currency is also in free fall. The action taken was, in fact, multi-purposed.
Okay, but wouldn't you be nervous right now if you were Syria or if you were Bashar Assad? And not because you're a bad guy, but because you're like, wait a second. I'm being used as a pawn here in a much larger game.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, somebody will suggest, if they haven't already, that this whole thing is a false flag. And I think the evidence is scant. Maybe it ends up stacking up in favor of that. But the chemical weapons use was a justification for actions desired to be taken anyway.
So when the elephants are fighting or at least talking to each other, you don't want to be a mouse.
Yeah. I mean, and the Syrians are really, I fear, something of a sacrificial pawn in a much larger geopolitical gambit. I mean, you've got China has completed here in the last week their communication jamming devices and installed them on the Spratly Islands. And in the same, you know, call it 1 week to 2 week period, has given its largest ever show of naval force in the Taiwan Straits, having 5 live fire military drills, with Mr. Xi being present for that. So the chessboard and the players are indeed, I think they're beyond Assad and Syria. And the comments from the Russian ambassador to Washington, I think, again, they support that. And they're chilling for me, for a guy who grew up with the Cold War threat being more of a reality and with higher odds. I mean, a Russian invasion of the United States was a greater likelihood than the White Sox winning the World Series. I mean,
well,
that's the house I grew up in.
Well, and we were talking about types of warfare. Okay. And it's compelling to me. You know, we've talked in other commentaries about how I like to do celestial navigation. I like to look at the stars, know where I am. And actually, we talked about how the Naval Academy has reintroduced celestial navigation just for this type of thing. You talked about the Chinese setting up a anti-communication site. Okay. Well, what that really means is GPS doesn't work. Okay. We live in a day of communication. If you can disrupt communication or you can confuse communication, you can literally shut down the world's largest military. So who knows what the unknown is? Now, I'm not trying to be a fearmonger here, but we talked about currencies being used as war. Okay. And we're talking about some of the statements that are being made with Tomahawk missiles to countries that are long distances away from Syria. But the equity markets, okay, I want to go back to the equity markets because I guess in an idealistic world, if people were afraid of what the outcome was going to be, the stock market would go down, a little like it did when Napoleon was fighting at Waterloo, okay? Or it would go up if people thought things were going well. But the equity markets right now don't seem to really be reacting to any of the clear dangers geostrategically.
Yeah, and I think a part of it is you've got so many signals and a confusion between signal and noise,
right,
which we've spoken of before. You know, you've got tweets from Donald Trump that we need a weak dollar, and yes, in fact, so far we're winning on the race to the bottom, at least in the last 12 to 18 months since he took office. But then, you know, as soon as he says something, Mnuchin steps in and says, no, dollar weakness, no, absolutely not. We believe in dollar strength. So, I mean, what is it? If it's we want dollar weakness and we want dollar strength, are we saying we want the average of the two? Or are we just basically confusing market participants such that they can't really make decisions? I mean, you've got the equity markets today, which are rallying in the face of extreme geopolitical pressures.
Right.
As if the tension late last week and sort of the downside volatility that we saw was because we didn't know what was going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were concerned. And now that we know the missiles have flown and it's a past tense thing and we've settled that, it's so much better now. We're going to have peace in our day. You know, Macron and Trump have given us, they delivered on their promises. They said the red line thing and they've acted. And I mean, it's interesting because the markets are acting. And again, we go back to that issue of volatility. They're acting like they don't know what the hell is going on.
Mm-hmm.
Because they'll go up 1,000 points and they'll go down 1,000 points and they'll go up 1,000 points and they're reacting to data. But the data doesn't have real meaning when half of it says one thing and half of it says the other, and you're left to, on a day-to-day basis, make a decision. What signals are the market giving us? How should we be responding and reacting? And again, I think that volatility is ultimately going to cause people to say, can't make sense of it. The risks are not worth it.
You know, we've talked about that volatility. A lot of the decisions, 70% or more, are made by algorithms anyway. And so it's hard for them to factor in things that we maybe don't even see, like the wag the dog scenario. Okay, you remember during the Clinton years, the Monica Lewinsky thing. Well, sure enough, Clinton launched an attack, you know, looking for Osama bin Laden at the same time that literally the press corps waiting for the Monica Lewinsky news, they were sitting in a tent watching a movie called Wag the Dog. Now, public perception right now, I'm not saying necessarily that Trump launched this because of what's going on with Mueller.
No, but he benefits.
Okay.
He benefits from a show of strength. I mean, you've got Mueller who's challenging the Oval Office via the Cohen file grab, and he definitely benefits from saying, look, you don't mess with the best or you die like the rest. I mean, he's messaging everybody. He's messaging Putin and he's messaging North Korea and he's messaging Mueller.
Yeah.
And he's messaging his base.
Well, let's talk about Mueller, though. How in the world do you get 35 blank subpoenas? Is that even constitutional?
Yeah, I don't, honestly, this is where I wish I had a law degree and could tell you what was upside down and right side up. And, you know, but yeah, the most recent request was for 35 subpoenas. That's for the Manafort trial. And it seems odd to me that you leave all, that's according to Bloomberg, you leave all the names blank so that you can fill them out later. I don't know if that's normal. It doesn't sound normal, but I'd love to get some comment.
That doesn't sound constitutional to me. What if I'm one of the blank spaces? You know, I thought a subpoena had to be approved.
Right. So then you've got the Syrian missile strike. And what does he get? Trump gets public distraction points.
Yeah.
Back to the WAG.
That's true.
Public distraction points, an affirmation from his base that he's a doer, not just a talker.
Right.
You know, and that in the context of so many of the things that he's sort of backed out. Now he's talking about, you know, re-engaging the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the TPP, which was one of the first things that he dumped when he came into office. So, you know, how do you balance out, again, information, which is communicating one thing, with information that you now need to communicate the opposite thing to create some sort of balanced perspective?
Well, and Trump's not the only guy talking and tweeting. I mean, look at how the information just immediately leaked out after the Cohen raid.
Oh, amazing. It took less than 24 hours for leaked information from Cohen's office to hit the Wall Street Journal.
Yeah, this is not the National Enquirer. It's the Wall Street Journal.
That's the $1.6 million settlement for another one of Cohen's clients, right? My question is, how does this not negatively impact Mueller? Okay. I mean, where he's let the dogs loose to go on a tear, where's the leash? Where's the leash? Because, I mean, at a certain point, you're breaking the law. If you take information and then all of a sudden it's being who leaked it? Who leaked it? Because it's either coming from the Department of Justice or it's coming from the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Southern District of New York, who he employed to get his work done. So Mueller's got an issue emerging in that more information that gets leaked from Cohen's office that was never supposed to be out, or is at least to be held in official channels. When it gets to unofficial channels, somebody's breaking the law.
You know, a few years ago, when we were sort of in the depths of our recession, you and I were walking the streets of Washington, D.C. It was during cherry blossom time. It was really, really beautiful. But we commented that you could go to almost any city in the United States, and they were really oppressed at the time. It was because business was tough. This is after the financial crash. Washington, D.C. looked just fine. And it really, I hate to be mean, but it's a town full of talkers. So this talk that comes out, you know, these guys get paid to talk, and that's really what they get paid to do all the time.
You know, Bill King is a good friend of ours, and he occasionally in his missives will include a famous quote, and it reminds me of one from Thomas Jefferson. If congressmen talk too much, how can it be otherwise in a body to which the people send 150 lawyers whose trade is to question everything, yield nothing, and talk by the hour?
And this is Thomas Jefferson.
That's right.
So there's nothing new under the sun.
No,
right?
But you know, you get the spending bill, which came through several weeks ago. It flew through congressional hands.
It looks like it was written by the Democrats to me, Dave.
2,300 pages, and they were given 24 hours to read it once they were in receipt of it.
Have fun.
This is just FYI for your information. My brother-in-law was a state legislator in Idaho, and he complained to a number of his colleagues that there was so much to read to keep up with all of the things that they had to vote on.
Mm-hmm.
And every colleague that he commented on, that this is a full-time job. This is taking everything I have just to read it, let alone time to sort of sit and reflect and look at the pros and cons. And colleague after colleague looked at him and said, are you kidding me?
You really read this stuff?
You actually read it. You've got to understand.
Okay, but without reading the 2,300 pages, let's talk about some of the key points, because it sounds like exactly the opposite of what Trump campaigned on.
Well, and it creates some vulnerability when you come into November. And I think the Trump voter base is going to wonder about record spending levels. They're going to wonder about a very minimal amount of funding for a wall. You know, $400 billion or more of the dollars allocated is actually going to just go to repairing existing fences.
Well, and there's no reversal of Obamacare.
Nope. Obamacare is in place. Planned Parenthood is funded. Sanctuary cities are funded. Now you've got the re-engagement, at least verbally, on Trans-Pacific Partnership.
Which is what he threw out. He threw TPP out right off the bat.
Right. So, I mean, I don't see how you don't have a massive loss of seats in the House. A growing likelihood, which, you know, I guess would really be no different than past administrations at this point in the cycle. You've had massive turnover. Maybe the one exception to that was George Bush. Because of 9/11, there was a lot of seats that were held and not a lot of turnover. But, you know, November enthusiasm amongst the GOP, I don't think it's going to be very high. Right. Look at Paul Ryan's exit. I think that's indicative not only of dysfunction in the House, but what is perceived to be a title shift, a major title shift. The only thing that I can think of that would sort of balance out that title shift towards the Democrats is if Mueller's probe is seen more and more between now and then to be a partisan witch hunt,
right,
which would certainly alter the tone amongst Trump supporters. And even though he's not delivering on the points that he said he was going to, you know, persecution of some sort is sort of a rallying point.
Don't you think, though, that everything would change if the debt actually caught up with us? You know, the big picture is we're talking hundreds of trillions of dollars of global debt. And that's really been allowing us to do just silly little things. Let's just put it that way. I mean, let's face it. We're dealing with silly little things because we're basically borrowing our kids' money.
The big picture realities, they're still in place. They remain. And while they sometimes sort of are obscured and are out of sight and to some degree out of mind, global debt levels have exceeded $237 trillion.
Yeah, how do you get away with that for forever?
That's 3 to 3.5 times global GDP. So the question you always have to ask with debt is, can you keep up with the payments? So, you know, scale, the size of debt is certainly one variable. The interest component is another, right? And you could argue that at 3 to 3.5 times global GDP, that the scale issue is becoming a real issue. Now, all of a sudden, we're beginning to see interest rate creep. And guess what? That's the kind of thing where you say, all right, well, the system is going to reveal all its frailties on the basis of a tightening of credit.
Which you said will probably have to happen only because the Federal Reserve is already 2 years behind its curve.
Interest rates have already been rising. The Fed's just pretending to catch up. So, but then domestically, fascinating tweet from Eric Pomboy this last week, $21.1 trillion in public debt, $15 trillion in mortgage debt, $9 trillion in corporate debt, $4 trillion in consumer debt, $6 trillion unfunded pension liabilities, Fed phasing rates, reducing balance sheet interest rate expense exploding, but everyone's concerned about a $100 billion trade war. Lots of laughs. I mean, again, $100 billion compared to tens of trillions of dollars, it's a fascinating thing, Kevin. I mean, look at CNBC's report this last week with Neil Kashkari, part of the Fed there in Minnesota. And he says the national debt is not a factor that the Fed weighs for the direction of interest rates.
Hmm.
I mean, Neil, higher rates, are you saying that they don't impact in a material way the $65 trillion in interest-bearing instruments here in the United States? No impact to household debt, no impact to corporate debt, no impact to the federal line item? At what point can we conclude that even though these are things they don't factor in, they are things that we have to factor in because they are realities?
Yeah, and whether they pay any attention at all to what the debt is, you know, the annual deficit, as we know, there are times when $200, $300, $400 billion, we're talking about $1 trillion plus from this point forward.
Well, CBO reconfirmed that here in just the last few days. Looked at the math all over again. Congressional Budget Office says that their official estimates are now going to be $1 trillion in annual deficits hitting by 2020. So the one thing that's implicit to that is that to this point, they've underestimated what it was going to be. And I think, quite frankly, it's fair to assume that they continue to underestimate not only the time frame, but the total quantities. Because, you know, look, are they factoring in the liquidations of treasuries from the Fed as the Fed reduces its balance sheet? Are they factoring in the net liquidations from foreign sources? Those were our current financiers of our debt. The Chinese, just as one example, the Saudis as another, the Japanese as another. You know, these kinds of liquidations, all of a sudden, you end up with $1 trillion, $1.5 trillion very, very quickly. I think that's what we're on tap for this year, is $1.5 trillion, not $1 trillion by 2020. What are the implications into the financial markets? I mean, join us for the Tactical Short conference call this Thursday. If you're stuck with an equity portfolio and are going to be long out the ears in a traditional allocation, you should be thinking about reducing risk. You should be thinking about at least three things: liquidation and raising cash, getting some sort of a hedge, a la the tactical short, owning gold as an offset to market chaos. You've been told over and over and over again that the facts are lining up for a very sour patch in the stock and bond market. And if you haven't taken action at this point, again, every opportunity has been given. Every opportunity has been given. It'll be a fascinating conversation. We look forward to your questions. And of course, we'll see you next week on the weekly commentary.
You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. Be sure to register for the Tactical Short Quarterly Call at mwealthm.com. mwealthm.com. That's mwealthm.com. And that's coming up Thursday, April 19th. So listen in. Thank you for listening.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.